right, our third case is Bundy versus the state of Texas. If Deborah, will you please announce counsel? Thank you. Mr. Henderson.
Thank you, Your Honor. I guess after listening to the first two cases, I can say now for something completely different. This is about murder. And if you look at the record in this case, which you will have to because there's a sufficiency claim, you'll see that it was a rather lively and vigorous trial. It was also basically a street fight that occurred in the parking lot of the City View Apartments in Fort Worth, Tarrant County, Texas, and I think it's quite interesting that something that happens in about 30 or 40 seconds gets such hindsight analysis, legal analysis, and quite a bit of Monday morning quarterbacking. The facts are fairly simple in that Philip Bundy, my client, known as Pat, and Rodney Price, which is the name of New York, had a little bad blood. It culminated with an event that occurred on February 27, 2005 in the parking lot at the City View Apartments in Fort Worth, Tarrant County, Texas. I guess to that extent, this case has something in common with the first case, as this is not a great apartment complex. New York had been drinking and smoking crack, and he came up, the state conceded that New York was the first aggressor, threw the first punch. Pat stabbed New York in the side with a knife, which Dr. Sizzler said caused death. There was also bad words prior to it, with New York saying, "I'm going to beat your ass." And even the state conceded that self-defense was an issue in the case. The first point of error is that there was some evidence of prior violent nature of the deceased. And the issue when you get a situation like this is the state of mind of the deceased. That's under Lewis versus State and Torres. There was an attempt to get into evidence prior ag assaults that were refused. I would anticipate the argument of, as seen in their brief, that perhaps a bill of accession should have been made. Our argument is that it was pretty clear in the record what kind of evidence we were trying to get in and what kind of evidence that Judge Westfall excluded. But we believe that it was an abuse of discretion to have.
Does the record suggest that appellant knew or did not know of the reputation of the defendant for violence?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think he knew that he was a bad actor. As far as all the details of the prior bad acts, there's no indication that he did. But my reading of Torres and Lewis is that you don't have to have a showing that the person who did the killing is accused of murder knew all of the prior bad acts for those bad acts to come in. You're trying to show the state of mind of the deceased, and so anything that would be relevant to that should come in would be our position. With regard to our issues, number two, where the court denied the request for a definition of apparent danger, we are going to have to concede that most of the case law is pretty much against us now under the Walters, and I think it's the Giebert cases. Justice Hervey in a CLE seminar this year pretty much made it clear that if it's not statutory, that you don't get the definition in the charge. We think that that's incorrect, but the old apparent danger has supposedly been inundated or taken into the elements of self-defense, and the courts have pretty much ruled at this point that we are not entitled to a separate charge on apparent danger. Our third point of error is that we think it was
Are you entitled to a charge similar to the reasonable person instruction? I mean, the fact that this is not a reasonable person standard?
My understanding is, under the cases that I cited, Walter and Giebert, that if reasonable person is not in a code somewhere, it's not going to be in the charge, all of our McCormicks and McClungs that have been published heretofore notwithstanding. So I don't know. If that's not in a code, and right now off the top of my head I can't remember if it is, my understanding is it would not come in. We believe that there was charge error under Almanza, which was not objected to, and that two theories were submitted to the jury as to the charge of murder. And once again, I'm glad I go to some of these seminars because apparently the cases are splitting somewhat, and the issue seems to be if the theory of the way the offense occurred involves an element of the offense, it has to have a separate submission. If it goes to such things as manner and means as to how something happened, such as intentionally and knowingly kill someone with a knife or intentionally and knowingly kill someone with a gun, or if you allege manner and means two different ways, you could submit them the same way. However, if it's elemental and two completely separate theories of submitting the offense, which we allege is what occurred here, then it should have its own separate charge. The first theory was that he took a knife, stabbed him, and intended to kill, kind of paraphrasing. The second way to kill somebody, at least another way in the statute, is to do an act clearly dangerous to human life, stabbing them with a knife. But those seem to me to be totally different elements of a way to commit murder and would have required fundamentally a separate charge. But again, it seems to be the way the cases are breaking down is it submitted as a separate element or just merely a manner and means. The fourth area, which I have admit to being an attorney of average intelligence because I have never been able to quite get a grip when we start arguing the concepts of sufficiency of evidence, legal sufficiency and factual sufficiency. We have raised the issue of factual sufficiency on the issue of self-defense. In my reading of the cases from the Saxton and the main cases on sufficiency of evidence, I see no distinction, at least no language saying we're talking about legal sufficiency or factual sufficiency. I guess since everyone agreed that self-defense was raised and it was submitted in the charge, it was legally sufficient to be given to the jury. Our position is that it was factually, there was enough evidence there that no jury could have denied the self-defense theory. And it's sort of like trying to prove a negative. And I have to admit, I have a hard time wrestling with the language there. But to me, the issue is, and this court, I think, has addressed it in Howard versus State, at least in the terms of a rejected affirmative defense. And here you have the deceased as the first aggressor. We did get in, there was in the record that he'd been smoking crack cocaine. An excited utterance by a person at the scene saying it was self-defense. The deceased verbally threatened to beat his ass and came up and attacked. I mean, it appears that everybody but the jury, I guess, decided that it was factually sufficient, but our position is that the evidence was so overwhelming that a jury could have reached no other conclusion but not guilty based upon the theory of self-defense. But I've not seen, and I hope this court will at least ride on the issue of distinguishing factual versus legal sufficiency with regard to the concept of self-defense. In conclusion, I would say that it is very easy for people to go back and pick up a code, sit down in the quietness of chambers or a law office and analyze what the words are in a code book. It's a whole lot different thing to be out there under attack on the street and not know exactly what you're facing. And here, at least ask you to consider the issue of self-defense, the fact that the court did not allow all of the evidence on the prior violence when you address this particular case.
Okay, let me see if I understand what you're saying. Because self-defense requires that you be responding in kind, so you have to respond to non-deadly force with non-deadly force, to deadly force with, then you can respond to deadly force with deadly force. So are you saying that your first point goes to the ability to show that the defendant perceived his attack as requiring the level of response that he used, and that failure to allow that evidence then prevented your being able to essentially try your lawsuit? Or what exactly are you saying?
It's a combination, Your Honor. I mean, we want to show that this guy has been, the deceased, was a violent person who attacked people and been charged with aggravated assault. Since the court submitted the issue of self-defense, then apparently there was legal evidence that they were responding to deadly force with deadly force. But one assumes the trial court would not have assumed, would have submitted the issue of self-defense. Because we do agree, at least as the law existed at that time, at least on the issue of retreat, that you could only use the force that was being used against you if you're the self-defender. In other words, unlawful force, a fist fight, can only be responded to by the same kind of force, but not deadly force. In this instance, we can see there was deadly force, but we believe that the decedent was also using deadly force, and that position is bolstered by the fact that the trial court and the state conceded that this was an issue of self-defense. So there is a concession that deadly force was being used upon my client, to which he responded with deadly force. And by excluding the evidence of his other prior bad acts, then that kept us from being able to put in even more evidence of what kind of a bad actor this was and why it was necessary to use deadly force at that particular time. I hope that clears it up. Wherefore, premises considered, we respectfully request for reversal and acquittal or for a new trial.
Thank you, Mr. Henderson. Mr. Curl.
May it please the court, my name is David Curl and I'm here representing the state. I intend to concentrate on point of error two and just briefly touch on a couple of the other points unless there are questions about the other points. I'll try to abbreviate it since appellants conceded that this instruction is now barred by Giesburg, but we've set out in our brief, we think there are three reasons that the judge had no obligation to give the special elaborate apparent danger instruction that appellant wanted, and the first is appellants conceded is that under Giesburg you don't get non-statutory defensive instructions anymore. Defense in the 9.32A2 is that the defendant has a reasonable belief that deadly force is needed, and that's the instruction that you should get. This apparent danger doctrine was all sort of a riff on that, which was in the same way Giesburg alibi was sort of a riff on the elements of murder, and it's just not the law anymore. And that point was made in Walters, where again it was an even more elaborate riff on apparent danger. Was the defendant wanted some instruction that prior verbal threats by the victim were relevant to whether or not he acted in self-defense, and the Court of Criminal Appeals said that's not in the penal code. It's just not a proper defense.
Okay, let me ask you this. The instruction that was given was whether the response was appropriate or whether the... It uses the term reasonable or reasonably. But case law has said that's not to be confused with a reasonable person standard. It's whether a person in the shoes of the defendant reasonably believed that the response was necessary. Now, you've said that it would be a comment on the evidence to tell the jury that it's not a reasonable person standard, but a reasonable response for a person in the defendant, or as seen from a person by a person in the defendant's, from the defendant's point of view. I'm confused how that's a comment on the evidence and rather than an instruction to the jury of the burden.
Well, we think it's much like the instruction that was found improper in Brown, where the Court of Criminal Appeals said you can't instruct the jury that a person's intent can be inferred from their words or conduct. Now, that's a perfectly correct statement of the law, but it's not something you should be telling the jury.
That's a comment on the evidence.
Well, so is this.
Why? How?
Well, you're telling the jury to consider all the facts and circumstances as they affect the defendant's mind. I mean, it's the same thing as telling him to consider anything he says or does in Brown. I mean, We don't believe that you should be giving instructions like that to the jury. It may be correct legally, but it's not something you have any business, a judge has any business telling the jury. And we also, I was going to get to this in a minute, we don't think that telling the jury that they should consider the facts from the defendant's perspective is proper either. We think that that's what should be abolished or was long ago abolished. Because
which that it should be or was?
Well, we think that the modern penal code effectively abolished that stuff. That stuff, we think, predates the modern penal code. And the problem with it is that the reasonable belief standard is defined in the penal code. It's in 107A42, and that's an objective test. So we're supposed to be applying an objective test, but this stuff about from the defendant's perspective is telling the jury to put themselves in the defendant's shoes. You're asking the jury to abandon their objective role. The state is not allowed to argue to the jury that you should put yourself in the victim's shoes. That would be asking the jury to abandon their objective role. So we don't think that it's proper either to tell the jury that they should consider this from the defendant's perspective. They should consider this objectively.
I thought your objection to the admission of the criminal record was that the defendant wouldn't have known it, and that is putting yourself in the defendant's position, that your knowledge is limited to what was in the defendant's mind. So, I mean, how can it be that it doesn't come in because the defendant didn't know it, and also you don't look at it from the defendant's point of view, which would include his knowledge? I'm confused here.
Well, first of all, I don't think that was our primary problem with Appellant's first point of error. Our major problem was that there wasn't any ambiguous conduct. In order to get prior acts of violence in from the victim, you're primarily going to rely on a theory that you had an apparent danger situation where these prior acts...
Apparent danger?
Right.
But they can't be charged on apparent danger.
Well, but still, there's still a lot of case law that talks about how you get extraneouses in from the victim.
And that would be the apparent danger, that is, from the perspective of the defendant.
That's the doctrine. But when I'm talking about jury charge issue, we're talking about admission of evidence at this point.
So you use it to keep the evidence out, but the jury can't be instructed.
Well, no, I'm just saying that the doctrine that is used to get in prior acts of the victim in was an apparent danger theory. And the theory was that if the victim did some ambiguous conduct, you'd get the prior acts of the victim in to show what he was really trying to do. And our main problem with the appellant's desire to get those priors of the victim in was that there wasn't anything ambiguous. Everybody agreed that the victim threw the first punch. You don't get to prove that the victim was in fact the first aggressor when everybody agrees that he was the first aggressor. So that was our primary problem with trying to get his first point of error. Also, that we don't know whether this witness was going to be able to provide the evidence he wanted since he didn't make a bill. But the other problem, I guess I've talked about the three reasons which we don't think this should ever be given this instruction, but there's even probably a more fundamental problem for appellant is that the Court of Appeals in Valentine said that if all you have to do to satisfy the apparent danger doctrine, even when it still existed, this was a 579 or 587 Southwest 2nd case, was instruct the jury on reasonable belief and then define reasonable belief. It's a very minimal requirement to satisfy the apparent danger instruction. Our judge went far farther than that in helping appellant. We set out in our brief at pages 14 and 15 some of the apparent danger instruction he gave. I should have also added on page 61 of the clerk's record, he went further and said, or she went further, quote, when a person is attacked with unlawful deadly force where he reasonably believes he is under attack or attempted attack, and I'm omitting some here, the law excuses or justifies such person in resorting to deadly force. Now, that's far farther than the Court of Criminal Appeals said you had to go in Valentine. He really has nothing to complain about on this apparent danger instruction, even if it was a theoretically valid instruction. And the final point I want to make about this instruction is that apparent danger wasn't even raised by the evidence. Everybody agreed that the victim was the first aggressor. Everybody agreed that the victim threw the first punch. this isn't an apparent danger case. There isn't any ambiguous conduct by the victim raising the issue of apparent danger.
Isn't the issue the degree of response that's appropriate?
The issue in order to get an apparent danger instruction, and when it was still proper, was there had to be some ambiguous conduct by the victim that could raise in the mind of a reasonable person that deadly force was being used against, or attempted to be used against the victim, or against the defendant.
Okay, so you're saying that the record was clear that deadly force was attempted to use against...
No, I'm saying that there was, first of all, there wasn't any ambiguous conduct. There was clear evidence that the victim was the aggressor. So that's, in terms of regular self-defense, there would be no problem. Now, I absolutely disagree with anybody who says that there was a deadly force self-defense instruction should have been given in this case. All we have was somebody started a fist fight and an appellant stabbed him in the heart. There's no way in the world that the judge should have charged this jury on self-defense at all. And anybody who thinks differently in the trial court, I think, was mistaken.
So let me clarify then, I think, a little difference between what you and Mr. Henderson said. I think from your briefing, you concede that the state admitted that the victim threw the first punch, but there was no concession that deadly force was ever used. Is that correct?
I can't remember what our prosecutor said at trial. I'll look at the record again. I don't recall the prosecutor ever agreeing that there was an issue of deadly force. I also don't agree that I don't believe they objected to the jury charge. But all that is, I think, is irrelevant. I mean, to decide whether or not an issue of deadly force is raised, you look at the record, not what the parties conceded. And the evidence was that the victim threw a punch at him and the victim stabbed him in the heart. I mean, there's plenty of cases that say you can't use deadly force in response to a fist fight. So we don't even think that appellant's fourth point of error even presents issues. There wasn't even anything for the jury to decide. There clearly wasn't a case of deadly force self-defense. And even if it was properly presented to the jury had every right in the world to decide that his response was not appropriate. The only other thing I wanted to mention briefly was with regard to point of error 3 on page 22 of our brief, we anticipated a decision from the Corpus Christi court in a case called Joseph. And that came out on July 10th of 2008. And it, for some reason, it's not on Westlaw, but it is on the Corpus Christi court's website. And they agreed with all the other courts that I know of that have considered the issue and have said that two different theories of murder are manners and means, and that there isn't any unanimity issue. That unanimity issues problems come up when you have either separate transactions or you have a penal code that contains separate offenses. It's a Vic situation where they told us in Vic that aggravated sexual assault has got lots of actual separate penal offenses in there and that you can't mix and match them. But every court that I know of that has looked at it has said that the different ways of committing murder are just manners and means and that the jury doesn't have to agree on them all. So unless there are any questions, we'll pray for an affirmance. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Curl. Mr. Henderson, rebuttal.
Always easiest to respond to the last point first. Our position, and we think if you look at the code, it's very clear that there's a very big distinction between taking a knife, intending to kill somebody, and maybe intending to do an act clearly dangerous to human life, not intending to kill them, that does kill them. Both do end up as murder, but both are separate and distinct ways of committing murder, which are not just about manner and means, even though they came from the same potential transaction. I also would find it interesting that the state, I think, trying to minimize the weakest part of their case was that they wanted to concede up front that he was the first aggressor. And I can't find the record cite at this point, but I believe at some point the state did say that this is about self-defense. I'm not exactly sure where that is in the record. I could be mistaken. But at any rate, because they concede he's the first aggressor, they then want to say that, therefore, we've conceded it, therefore, no more evidence comes in on that particular topic. It almost seems like a lot of times when a defendant is ready to plead guilty and admit to a particular offense like murder, the state still brings in everything but the kitchen sink, even though there's a guilty plea and a concession that all we're going to do is go to punishment. They bring in all of the evidence of the murder. So, I mean, it was certainly what the defense wanted to do was show what an aggressor this person was, and preventing preventing the introduction of those acts under 404, we think, was error and amounted to harmful error. While we concede that the case law is against us on our issue two with regard to the instruction, it doesn't mean that we are conceding that it's right. We think it's wrong, and we're not giving up on that issue, and we still think that we should have had an instruction on it. Anyway, unless the court has further questions, that concludes my argument.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Henderson. Mr. Curl, your case is submitted. We appreciate your arguments and briefing today. You are excused. If the clerk will now adjourn us.
All rise.